I'm Shalina Tobin, aka Posh Nosh Gal, and today I'm joined by the brilliant chef, Kurth Gums. From his origins in the Caribbean, he learned his art with some of the most talented chefs in the world. You may recognize him from his appearances on the Great British Menu this year, but his day job is head chef at the highly celebrated Orma restaurant in the heart of Mayfair in London. Hello, Kurth. How are you?
Hi. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing very, very well. And so Orma Mayfair, it's back. How does it feel to be back after such a long break?
It actually feels good. You know, we're still, as ever, you know, trying to catch our stride and adjust to everything that's going along. But, you know, I can say from a chef's point of view, sometimes having more time to be at home with family and friends is great. And then having too much time given to you that you didn't really expect or wanted can be a bit of a negative. So it's good to be back in the kitchen and you know, getting a bit of that energy again, going along and feeding off of guys and their adrenaline. So yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know it must have been a really stressful time when restaurants were told to close. But did you end up enjoying some of your lockdown time with the family? Did you spend quality time with them?
Yes, definitely. I mean, like I said, it's a present, all gift wrapped, to being able to, you know, have a Saturday night at home with your kids and your family. So I enjoyed it a lot. We did a lot of baking, a lot of cooking, and just, you know, playing around outside in the trampoline and teaching my youngest son how to ride a bicycle. So it was really good, you know.
And you've got four kids.
Yes.
That's a mouthful. And so do any of them cook?
Yes. My oldest one, he's 11. Mm-hmm. Really good. I think he's more pulled towards a pastry, I think, because like he would say, daddy, I want to make a cake. And I'll be like, okay, yeah, go for it. I'll wake up, you know, 7:30, and I'll come to the kitchen and he's already done testing the cake. I don't have to do nothing. He Googles his own recipes, probes his cake, tests it, take it out, you know, chucks on whatever, Haribo, Skittles, and just melt it down, make his own garnish. But in essence, the cake is actually edible. It's really good, not too sweet. It's light. And yeah, he's good. He can make pastas. He can fry a steak, make a pasta sauce. You know, he's all right.
Well, is the pressure on for him? I mean, you must feel it, especially after your appearance on TV.
Yeah, and I think that was something like instilling that like memory and that experience for him as well. I think it would never go away. I mean, taking him with me through that program, it was great. It was great. So I know definitely he's going to have something to look forward to. And, you know, we are competitive even as chefs, but even me in terms of training and instilling certain, you know, principles with my own kids, he's definitely going to be looking to outdo me. And that's all I want as well, you know, to do your best.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to talk about the Great British Menu a little bit later on. I just wanted to cover some of your beginnings first, actually. So you're originally from Anguilla in the Caribbean, where you had a little bit of a rough start. Tell us a little bit about that time and how you actually got yourself into cooking.
So, it's in the Caribbean. I mean, it's a small island on the map. Like I always say to everyone, it's just like a dot, a pencil dot on the map. And you can just barely read the word Anguilla. But having been like 35 square miles, population of only about 16,000 people. And, you know, it's surrounded by beautiful resorts, you know, top beaches, great food, great people. But, you know, it was a bit rough in terms of coming up. And you're finding yourself in certain groups of, you know, so it can make it a little bit more difficult for you in terms of going to school and so forth. You know, you wasn't sure of, you know, when your next meal is going to be and so forth. So, you know, going to school, I was involved in a lot of different things that not always you're proud to be talking about. But nevertheless, this was my story. This was me growing up and having that kind of troubles on top of troubles going to school. It was, you know, more and more of a pressure, a lot of a heavy load, which drawed me a little bit more of a delinquent, you can say, a little bit more negative. But on the top end of that, you always had support and teachers and so forth that will engage you to do other stuff, whether it was track and field, or was, you know, great in that, whether it was cooking. We all had a choice to choose between three compulsory subjects when you're going to fourth and fifth form, and that was auto mechanics, woodwork, and food nutrition. So, you know, I used to just walk around doing my assessment, trying to figure out where do I want to be? Where do I fit in? And looking through all the windows and walking around and so forth. And it was dominated by boys, the auto mechanics and woodworks class, you know, chiseling away, banging things away, looking under hoods and getting all oily and dirty. And it didn't really appeal to me, you know. I wasn't really one of those type of boys was talking about supercars or building this or building that. I was never the kind of creative guy with my hands of making stuff. But when I was walking over to the food nutrition's class, you know, looking into the window, there was like 16 girls, 2 boys. And I was like, whoop, that's the class for me. I'm going in there, you know. But that was one pulling fact. But at the end of it, I was thinking, you know, behind of it, cooking was something that resonated with me because my mom, you know, she's a very good chef on Ireland. Everyone knows my mom. And I was thinking it's going to be a plus because at least if I know every Thursday or Friday, whenever we're doing food nutrition class, whatever I cook, I'm going to be able to take home and eat. So I know that was a solid score. You're going to definitely be eating every Thursday. And, you know, going into the class, you know, shortly after, you know, the teachers, one of the teachers that I very much well respect, Miss Foy, you know, she would always say, oh, you boys are really doing good against the girls and this and that. And before you know it, like all that encouragement and stuff, we end up opening, me and one of my best friends who was in that class as well, a pizzeria on the island, you know, when we were finishing high school. And it made sense to do that because his uncle had the leading and still does have the leading bakery in my island. And we would have got all the equipment and so forth, you know, as a tag along to be able to make our pizza dough and do all a little trialing. And so we like, you know, little kids just being ambitious and trying to do something out and stay from off the streets from getting in trouble. So we opened a pizzeria and it was called Lemino's Pizza. It was just a knockoff. It means let me know what you want. And, you know, it was good. So we did that for like a year and a half or so before then I decided I want to list something else. And I went into a 5-star hotel on the island. And it's there when I started to learn about the expediting and how to carry a tray and, you know, walking down from the main part of the kitchen down to the beach restaurant with trays. It's a different stability and balance. And, you know, being around the first time seeing actual chefs doing the TV tricks, flambéing, throwing wine, getting those lobsters and just, you know, all the fire and stuff. It was just amazing, captivating, pulling me in. So it's there when I started to see a little bit more about the kitchen side of things. And as I say, you know, my mom was throughout always catering to birthdays, weddings, funerals, you name it, you know, you're calling her to cater and she's always tagged me along and dragged me with her. And, you know, those days used to be long and boring, but when you are actually serving and eating the food, it was happy days because everybody was always so complimentary and telling her how great the food was. And that's, you know, the sounds of appreciation is something that sticks with me and that, you know, you're being awarded or, you know, acknowledged for bringing comfort and happiness to people regardless of the theme, whether it's a funeral or a birthday or whatever, you know, through food you're bringing happiness. So I wanted to be a part of something like that. But cooking was, I would say, not the first part of me in terms of deciding to be a chef. I was heavily involved in athletics and I had a scholarship. And you know, for different reasons, the scholarship had fell through, they postponed it for six months. And at that age, I was like, you know, like, no, why? You know, why would, I'm the second fastest in the school, I've, you know, represented the island here, there, and there. And I couldn't understand it. And I was like, no, that doesn't make sense. So I kind of like started to look at what the next thing was going to be for me, because I was a bit disgruntled as well by them trying to postpone my scholarship as a mechanism to discipline me for whatever they see fit. So, you know, moving on, long story short, you know, I talked to my dad and X, Y, and Z, and we arranged and hooked up very quickly, I must say. You know, in 2003, September, we talked about culinary school, and by 2004, January, I was on a plane over here getting frostbite. So, yeah.
And what was it that actually pulled you to London? Well, over anywhere else?
I think it was a mixture of two things. One, because I remember in that food nutrition class, we did have scouts coming from Le Cordon Bleu, and they were telling us about the school. So in my mind, it was about the school either in California or the school in Tatola, which is also in the Caribbean. But when I talked to my father, when we did the, he did the research more or less, he chose the furthest one away, so I won't be able to just get a boat ride or 2-hour flight back home. So I can get away from the island, get away from the delinquency, you know, the juvenile behavior and all this type of stuff. So it was more like, I think, him tricking me and saying, this is the best way. But at the end of the day, it was more advanced to come to London, or if you was going to go to America. But on the American side, it's more accessible for me to be able to reach back home faster. Right. And I think that was the idea behind of it. Just get me far away and just let me submerge myself into a world that's been advanced and let me sink or swim.
And you absolutely did that. I mean, you've got great experience behind you, and you started, so you, as you mentioned, you went to Le Cordon Bleu. That was 15 years ago now. How has that opened doors for you?
I think, one, it's commendable. Le Cordon Bleu, the school is state of the art. It's a great institution. You know, all the produce was fresh. It was luxury ingredients. There wasn't shine away. It is an expensive school, but they do have a lot of quality. The demos, the practical rooms, the teachers that came in to teach you, you know, it was great. I would say that at that time when I was going to school, even when I was, you know, graduating, finishing, when I was looking for, you know, first level entrance into different kitchens, I didn't have some of the connections that they have now, because I'm in quite good communications with the school now. And I would found as I go along, like my first day, I also remember when I went into the kitchen for this first day of trial and the guy sent me down to the fridge. I came in, you know, my jacket all looking decorated up, you know, I feel like I'm wearing a badge, you know, my chest is up. So I'm like, good, you know, but you know, what does a, you know, 18-year-old, 19-year-old kid knows about being in a real kitchen? So he sent me down to the fridge for some, I think it was Chevel or something like that. And I went down, I couldn't tell which one was Chevel. From sage to parsley to coriander, they all looked the same. So I just grabbed the whole bunch, wrapped them up, bring them up. And he like looking at me, because I was walking around a little bit, you know, pushy or cocky, you can say, with my jacket, I'm feeling good. I graduated. I got a grand diploma. And you know, it meant nothing. I didn't get the job, by the way. I didn't get the job. They probably were just pissing off, laughing at me. But at the end of the day, I realized as I go along in the places that I chose to work and for different people, as I started to give myself a bit more credit and rise to the level of the ranks in terms of acknowledgement, then the diploma was more valued and respected in that line. Yes, you can say, oh, I have the diploma and you go in, but it gives you a wake up call, not because you went to Le Cordon Bleu, which is state of the art, that means you're gonna jump the ladder. No, I started at the bottom and I worked really, really hard. And as you go up, then it starts to mirror the effect and saying, oh, Kurth Gums, also a grand diploma of Le Cordon Bleu, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. But before the grand diploma, it wasn't saying anything for the respected chefs who was doing this day out. They was like looking down at it. What I did have is, you know, thankful I had a good base of French cuisine, because, you know, even the recipes, a lot of them was in French, the teachers was French. I did have a good background, and, you know, French chefs for me at that age, and even now, they're highly acclaimed and looked upon. When you think about food or you think about superior cuisine, you were thinking about the French way. So I had a good basis from Le Cordon Bleu, but it was a kind of a rocky road, just going through and proving yourself and trying to bring more meaningful essence towards that diploma.
Yeah, well, you know, hard work really pays off, and it obviously showed, because you work with some of the top names in the industry, with Joel Robuchon, Tom Akins, Jason Atherton, and now you're at Sean Rankin's restaurants as well. What are the lessons that you've learned from some of those people, and that actually the lessons that make you are the chef you are today?
Okay, there's a lot of things. I think at that time, and going through those kitchens, they work very different, like from the Tom Akin style to the Joel Robuchon style. And you know, obviously I was a part of that team for the first atelier that opened, I think it was 2007, 2008 in London. And you know, worked there until they get the first star, until they get the second star. So that was about two and a half years before I moved on. And their approach to things was quite different to how the British was, but at the same point in time, everybody was really into the produce and the food. And when you were at Tom Akin's, there was, you know, that was the flagship restaurant. It was a militant machine, and his style of food was very, you know, captivating. His artistry was, you know, amazing on the plate, but it was a very different mindset that you need to be in that kitchen at that time, or to as opposed to another kitchen. Mm-hmm. And what I always learn and what I think about is, don't be shy to look over people's shoulders. You know, you don't wait for people to come and teach you or invite you to learn. You know, if you're going to do a section and you're doing it for the last 6 months, then there's no reason why you can't do that with your eyes closed per se in 3 hours time, and then open up on the next 3 hours for you to go somewhere else and, you know, knock on someone's shoulders. Hey, let me do that for you. Or show me how that's done. You know, it's all about learning in your spare time rather than waiting for people to invite you over. And not all kitchens are open or welcoming to it, but I always encourage my own personal chefs to, hey man, you know, crack on with your veg prep, come over here and, you know, get onto a fish, get onto a piece of meat, you know, and because you're never going to just say, oh, a chef de partie and I can prep meat, I can prep fish, without being able to given the chance to mess it up. And not saying that that's what you want to do, but it's something that has to become an extension of you, like you writing with a pencil or a pen. It's a stencil, like using your knife. So, you know, you are going to, you know, misjudge how you cut that portion or fillet that fish. And it's okay. It's okay. So, you know, I've learned a lot of that to be more patient, to be more encouraging towards the people that are with me, because I know when I was trying to, you know, look over people's shoulders or go around and meet you at the roundabout, there wasn't all welcoming or inviting. You know, everybody was turning their shoulders, shaving, and, you know, doing stuff to like sabotage. So it's unfortunate, but yet this is how it was back then for my own personal experience. Not means that it's for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I think what I've learned from these things that can be viewed as slightly negative is all these things, I take it and turn it into positives in my own kitchen right now. Like, for instance, every Saturday night, without fail, I always have a chef's meeting. You know, once we finish deep clean, we have a little bit of a meeting. And I think it's like a way of having a bit of chef's therapy, because many times, whether you're, you know, commis or chef de partie or demi, whatever your position, sometimes you have things to say, you bottle it up, and that can make you a little bit frantic. It can make you a bit nervous. It can make your job retendency less, because you might be irritated for something that is unaware to me or the others, and they might just up and quit and leave. And then tomorrow morning you come, you're starting fresh. I give them a chance to speak all around in a circle. And it's not about holding any power. It's not about solving any issues right there and then. But what it is for me is about allowing everyone to hear and be considerate of these situations. Whether it's like, for this week, every morning I was the only one putting away the vegetables. Or for this week, it was only me doing this and cleaning down. It would be nice if da-da-da. Oh, that one, you showed me this, thank you. It's whether the thanks, it's whether the little things that irritates you. We say it not one-to-one, not just with me, but just openly, and everybody hear it. And what I hope from that is, you know, I've been doing it since I've been here for 4 years now. So what I hope for that is, as we go along for the next working day and the next shift, is that when that issue that was raised is about to reoccur, at least you might be a little bit more concerned. Oh no, I shouldn't do that. Or that person doesn't particularly like this. And that's all we want to do. Bring a bit more awareness, a bit more consideration, and to dilute some of these frustrations. And hopefully we'll get a bit more longevity out of the staff working in a place that they're happy to work in. So ideally ending up producing better food with happy chefs.
Well, you sound like you're a really great mentor to them as well. And actually, I just remembered something that you once said, that Chef Julian O'Neill, he was a great motivational influence on you. So tell me about that. In which ways was he a great influence on you?
I think one, because Julian was probably the first chef after those chefs that didn't accept me when I didn't know what the herbs was. He accepted me in his kitchen, and I stayed there. That was at Terence Conran's restaurant, the Cragolino's. That was like years and years ago. Mm. And so I stayed there, and I really worked, and I was always very energetic. And you know, he was very encouraging. I guess he saw some things in me. And about 2.5 to 3 years later, he did suggest to me that, you know, I need to feed this energy that I have and I need to go and work somewhere more challenging for me. Because I was hot lard, fish, sauce, veg, you name it, I was there. And I became like a chef turned up at a, you know, within my first 2.5 years, just cracking on, moving. And he's the one that recommended me to go to Tom Akins, actually. And so when he told me to do that, then I took the advice. I went, I did my trial up, and, you know, I got through successfully, etc. And that was really good. It was a very, very difficult period, but at the same point in time, it is food that I like. It's things that, you know, comes helps to shape these things that I, you know, I embody now. But at the same point in time, I do understand that whatever experiences I take from there, every chef or everybody has a story to tell, and this is things that just adds to it, and nothing is forever. So I only can ever, you know, tip my hat to Tom Akins and to Julian O'Neill for these things, and everyone that I've worked for, really. But Julian, so after I finished with Tom Akins, I went to Robichon, and after I finished with Robichon, I went back to Julian O'Neill, because I was 6 years into just Michelin star environment, and those are extremely long hours. And though I was, you know, very, you know, pushing in terms of learning new techniques and to cook and manage a section and so forth, people, it was not me. That, you know, sometimes the more mean, the better it is, because you have a less tolerance working these long hours and having such a high expectation for the fine dining and the cuisine that you're doing. You know, we didn't have time to want to do something, mess it up, and then show someone and do it again. No, I'll do it myself. But then really and truly, it's not just about yourself. So when I went back to Julian O'Neill at the Woosley, it was more, not because of the food, it was to learn how to manage not people, but myself. You know, at that time I was very, very temperamental and so forth. And, you know, it was a great, as I say, he was a great figurehead, and, you know, he's always seen something in me and pushed me to do other things. So I learned a bit more of the managerial side, you can say, as I would say, more the humane side of things and balancing that as being a chef. Before then, I started to get the craving again, like, I want to do better food. I want to do more food. I want to see, you know, new things and push the boundaries with, you know, techniques and so forth. So then after, again, about 2.5 to 3 years, it always comes up that time, that hunger, that yearning again. And then I left, and I went back into Michelin, and then here, and then Singapore, and, you know, it's been all over after that. But yeah.
So when you talk about, you know, when you go, and I found that quite interesting, when you learn about calming your temperament, would you say that that makes you a better chef? Does that make you a better learner when you're just calmer within yourself?
Yeah, I would say so. I think, like, I'm not saying that, again, it's not for everybody how they are. I'm just relating just to the things that I know within myself, and being able to tell the truth about how I, you know, I saw things and how I act out upon things. And I think it is a part of growing. It's a part of evolving. It's a part of, you know, getting up the ladder, dealing with certain situations differently. At the same point in time, you don't think that the temperaments that you have, you know, they're not always to be used as negative influences. You know, sometimes the same temperament you have are productive in terms of it helps to you to push yourself further, because you are, you know, discontent of what you can achieve. You know, you can do better. Your manager, your head chef, they expect better, because you're trying to achieve a Michelin star. You're trying to do great food, or, you know, you learned something for the last 1 year, and then you do this and it doesn't really pan out. Why? You know, it's like you learn your ABCs, and then one day you come in and I don't know my ABCs anymore. That's frustrating. Why? What's going on here? So it was more like that. You know, it was different types of anger, but it was trying to put myself on the trajectory track of where I wanted to go. And, you know, that's where it comes from.
Right. And so just going back a little bit with Joël Robuchon, did you actually get to meet him?
Many times. I mean, he used to call me Piet of the Caribe, because around that time is when you had Pirates of the Caribbean, the movie that came out. He used to come in and he used to say that, you know, we couldn't have too much discussions because he was just strictly French. And I remember I was like a senior chef of the party on the meat section. And every time he would come in, like every 3 months or so, this was a new branch, obviously. So every time he comes in, everybody just scattering over the place. There's just more French than normal. I'm just a little, you know, Caribbean, English, patois speaking guy, not understanding anything. And right. They said, they were always like, if I'm cooking on the section now, and I'll have a commie doing my mash or my whatever, when Joël Robuchon comes, I become the commie, the sous chef comes onto the section, and I start doing the mash, right?
Right.
So at one point in time, I think it was on his third or so visit or fourth visit, you know, they decided to let me stay up because he was only always in French. And they said to me, in order for me to do that, to stay up and show the service while Mr. Robuchon, because he was very, very respected. Everybody was just on their P's and Q's when he was in, nothing out of place. And it's quite a, you know, consistent brand. So they said to me, I need to learn more of my dishes in French, because everything was calling out in French. Didn't know it, even though I went to the French speaking school, etc. So I went home, I studied my whole menu and the next month's menu, just in terms of the names of the ingredients, so I can understand what's away, you know, and what is the word for away, what is the tables. And very importantly, they told me, learn all your numbers in French, because they used to have this massive piece of entrecote that used to go out to the guest table, and they will just mark on the beef, and it will come back, and then I'll have to cut the same portion, weigh it, and then I'll have to be able to tell them in French, you know, it's, you know, Dusson, whatever, quatre francis, et cetera, et cetera. So they can say and charge the amount of money for this beef. So if I didn't learn these numbers very quickly, I would have lost the opportunity to be able to cook services while Joël Robuchon was on the pass. So I had a couple of services with him there, and it was great, you know, and I felt a great, you know, reward of being able to achieve that, even though it was just speaking numbers. I still can't speak, but, you know, he asked me a number, I know what to say to get me by. And that is just one of the challenges, you know, you have to do it in order to surpass certain things. But as every minute, it would be me at the back doing potatoes, or I'll be downstairs doing more potatoes. And as you know, he's famous for the potatoes. So, yeah, you just wanted to represent and know that they trust you enough, whether you're French by blood or by speaking or not, to be able to be there and do it. And that shows as well, if you're going to train and, you know, focus on their craft and learn among them, which is the best, then, you know, you'll be given some kind of leeway.
Right. And is that true, though? So do people actually order the mash for dessert? Have you ever heard that?
Mash, I'm telling you. Again, like, one of the best things I used to eat from there, and everybody used to eat it from there, is just a plain piece of sourdough bread on the tabanaki, because you cook it on the tabanaki, just toast it up. And we just spread the mash onto bread like it's butter, because it is so rich and creamy, indulgent. And I think if you eat too much, you can, you know what I mean? But it was very tasty. Like, it might sound like, ew, like when people say, oh, you're eating bread with chips, or you're eating bread with mashed potato. Well, that's what we used to have. You want a quick snack, easy? Kernel of mash on your bread, swoop it down, and we're chumming. We're going down. It was really good. Really good.
And do you have the similar mash in your own kitchen?
When we do mash, I do follow that principle. I do follow that principle,
it's
yes.
Like, and 50% butter and 50% potatoes, right?
More or less. It's like, given the way they treat it, it was like 3 kilos of mash to like 2 kilos of butter. So yeah, it's quite a lot. Quite a lot. And it's a daunting job, because, you know, I used to do a similar version as well at Tom Akin's. And then that was, you know, one headache. And when from Tom Akin's, when I went to Joël Robuchon, and then they was doing it again, it was even more processing, you know, cook the potato, pass the potato, cook it down, spit it with milk, add your butter, pass it again, put it up. Oh my gosh, it was a lot a lot of potato, just this. Oh, that's all you're doing is this or this, you know?
Yeah, you got the muscles for it, so. So how did the opportunity come about to work with Sean Rankin?
It was one of my chefs who, from with Julian and Neil, we worked together there for about 2 years, one of the guys there, and he left and he went and did some other stuff. And it was a time when I left the arts club and I was just moving on to like open for the next venture. And I was, you know, hanging around for about 2 months. I was working, but I was still not like, you know, I was looking for my next thing. And he was aware of it as well. And he was head chef within the company for one of the other restaurants that Sean had. And I think he told Sean about me. And then they kind of called me over. I came maybe the next day afternoon, or the same day in the afternoon, actually, for a meeting. Then followed by the next day for another meeting. And from there, then it was onto a series of cook-offs, followed by a 3 month stint in Jersey and in his restaurant there. Mm-hmm. Then it was back here to start to work on pre-opening. So yeah.
Wow. And how much freedom do you have to be creative with a menu?
Yeah, I have quite a lot of freedom. And I mean, I've been doing the menus from day one, you can say, from in the first year. There was a few dishes that Sean would have that was signature. There was about three or four dishes that was signature at the very beginning as well that would sit alongside here. Mm-hmm. But all the other dishes in terms of, you know, changes, we used to do a lot of du jour changes, special menu changes. It was always me. I used to always be, you know, doing a lot of draft tastings and so forth. So in terms of creative freedom, there's no big holdback there. I mean, there's always something somewhere. But in terms of creating the menu, I'm happy to say I've been going along steadily in trying to go within the flow and as well trying to sit alongside what our customers are in terms of our clientele and how they come in and what they expect to eat, what they like to eat. And sometimes that's about as well just trying new stuff and being very creative.
Right. And Orma's been open for, it's around 4 years now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was there last year, absolutely loved it. How much has your style of cooking changed since you've opened it?
Yes, I'll definitely say there is like changes, and that is influenced by a few things. You know, I think a lot of chefs maybe it is influenced by the seasonality, mm-hmm. what produce is available. It goes as well. I think it always worth, like I said, mentioning your staff in terms of how strong they are, because I don't believe sometimes as well it doesn't make sense. I put dishes on the menu that only me can do or recreate. It has to be able to go straight through. I believe a lot in cross training. It's not just about pastry chef or kitchen chefs, you know, just chefs. I create all of the desserts, but equally so my pastry chefs can come in the kitchen and do the colada, or my garnish chefs can go into pastry and do it. You know, we always have some skill tests. You always have to do cornels or chocolate writing or something. And my style has been evolving with the people that's been getting more comfortable where they're able to be on more than one section. So I have a bit more diversity, so I can have a bit more pillars of strength. And, you know, as well, quite worth mentioning is the plates and so forth, whatever we are buying in. You know, I get some spanking ideas whenever time I see a really sexy plate or something like that. But it is all up to a lot of things, I think. Seasonality, the strength of those within and around you and how you filter that around, and you know, the aesthetic part of things. And that is, again, it determines by, you set out to say you want to do fine dining, the people that come into the restaurant, you know, they expect fine dining. So we try to always offer that top level of service, not just through food, but I mean in the front part as well with the restaurant. The staff is very clued up, and the restaurant managers, you know, she pushes on as well. So yeah.
And have you ever been tempted to put any Caribbean influences on the menu?
Yes, I think I've done few of the things, like it's all about my different travels. Some stuff I like Asian flavors, it would come from Southeast Asia, from my time in Singapore, or some things would come from the Caribbean. Like I just came back, I get fresh ideas, and you whack on all the coconut and Malibu and pineapples into your desserts, but not just as how you will expect them to be in layman terms. There's always some twists or creativity. So we do put things within certain parts and categories of the menu where I can. Yeah, and it's something I look forward to even more, as long as it's gonna like sit well. Like, you know, I just did this Johnny cake, for instance, and you know, that is gonna be great as a little boosh, and we'll be offering that a little time soon, later in September, but I'll talk about that a little bit later.
Okay, so what type of experience are you looking to create with your menus from a diner's perspective?
I think as a diner, when you come in, you know, you, even me, when I go and eat, I like to be captivated by what's on the plate. First of all, we all say you always eat with your eyes, things are pretty, but even more so, it has to be really tasty and interesting. It's, for me, I prefer to have tasting menu when I'm going out to eat than just the a la carte dishes, because I like to see as much creativity throughout the whole menu, and I take more inspiration that way. And as well, not necessarily saying, oh, I have to like that flavor, but I like the way that it's presented. I like the way that's plated. I like the way that's served. I like the plate it comes on. I like the flavors within it. So there's always something that I can take from many different dishes through tasting menus when I go out personally eating. So when my customers come in, I want them to see the food as inviting, you know, see the food as creative comfort, you know, not that they're going to shy away from it and figure out like, what am I going to do here? No, it's okay. You know, if you want to pick this up with your hand, go ahead. If you want to use your knife and fork, go ahead. You know, we're very relaxed in the sense of that type of etiquette. But obviously, within fine dining, when you come in, you know how you would like to eat. And all for me, I want to make sure that I get across great flavors in compatibility with a great presentation, you know.
And you mentioned that, you know, you get a little bit of inspiration when you go to other restaurants as well. Where do you like to dine?
I always put a list together, like for every New Year's or within the first month of January, of a few restaurants that I might come across throughout the year. And I put them on like a little bucket list, and I would try to go to one every 2 months or every 3 months or something like that. And it's from fine dining to up and coming chefs to the new street food trend. And I'll just put them down in my notes, and then I'll go and visit them, you know. So earlier this year for Tom Akins, he just had opened Muse. I had that on my list. I went, Jewel Robichon opened just opposite door to me here in Mayfair. Put that on my list. I went. And unfortunately, I didn't do much more than that because I was in March. The COVID came. So, yeah, but, yeah, you know, last
so you,
year.
You made it to Tom Akins. So that must have been really interesting, because obviously you'd worked in that kitchen and you trained with Tom Akins. How did it feel to go back to his restaurant after all this time and dine at his new place, Muse?
Yeah, it was good. I think it when I saw it, all the hype starting to come around, and it was just around the corner, it was like one of those things that I definitely just have to get on the list. And yeah, we went there. The food was amazing. No doubt. We didn't fault that in any way. Tom himself was there as well. We had a little chat, so that was super cool. And just the intimacy of just sitting right there next to the kitchen and watching him, as I've watched him so many times, do what he does, you know, run a tight ship.
Yeah, well, you've got a perfect view, right? So you're sitting in the restaurant. It's an open kitchen, so you can see everything going on.
Yeah.
It's a lot of pressure.
It's intimate, but it was beautiful. It's nicely done. Yeah.
Yeah, we were there just before COVID hit. Actually, I think we were probably the last sitting, and it was phenomenal. Absolutely loved the dining experience there. So who else in the industry inspires you today? Who are the big chefs that you can say, oh, this guy really, really inspires me?
So far, I really like, I like to see restaurant Franzen Zen. I like to see their food. I think his brand of restaurants where he do, even from the head chef in Singapore to Sweden. I really like their style of food. Before I like the creativity of Alinea by Grant Ashitz. I like the innovation of Rene from Norma. And I think these are just things on a curiosity level, you know, really to say you've done it as a chef and you feel that different inspiration that they're giving out through thousands and millions of followers that they have through social media and always pushing the boundaries of creativity and innovation. So you take little inspirations for different things, even as an educational point of view. I'm in no way saying, oh, you know, I want to go there and see if it's really going to blow my mind. No, I want to go, I want to go there and experience whatever it is I can experience through what they are doing. Because, you know, I do think they are doing things that are groundbreaking, that are, you know, recognizable and so forth. So, yeah.
And you're a chef as well that's constantly pushing yourself. Is this one of the things that led you to enter the Great British Menu?
Yes, I think. Yeah, definitely. That was on my list to do. You know, I came in 2004. That started about 2006. From the same year it started to the next year, 2007, I was always watching that program for inspiration. I mean, they had loads of legendary chefs always turning out. And again, somebody here, there, and there, more than one was, you know, doing some stuff that was making you think like, oh, that's interesting. Oh, you can do that. That's new. That's not. So I always saw it and I wanted to be amongst the best in terms of being on a platform that was, you know, showcasing chefs of that caliber. And I've always said it. And 15 years later, I finally got an opportunity and, you know, I went there. And what I wanted to do is definitely not go home in the new format on the second day, because they were sending chefs home on the second day and then on the Thursday. And then I just wanted to be able to show my whole menu and really see if it is what I set out to do for all these years, that hunger that I had there, if I can actually push myself and be represented amongst them. And I was very happy with finally being able to be just there. You know, it was intimidating. It was exhilarating experience, but I was just happy to be there.
Yeah, well, you did phenomenally well. You made it to the finals. And that theme based on children's books, that was an awesome theme. But how did you find it? Did you find it very difficult?
Initially, when I got a brief, I started thinking, wow, what am I going to do here? But as you go along, like, you know, it settles in, like on the third day, I'm a busy person in my mind when I'm starting to think about food. You know, I don't sleep that well. It's just in there. I wake up, it's in there, it's coming out. It's always thinking. And then trying to fit dishes to the brief. And, you know, you put my hats off to some of the people that was in the competition. I don't know how they got such creativity and props made within the short time frame to be, you know, enter your dishes within the first part of the brief. I had to get these in and that in. It was amazing because you're thinking about it, when you say children's literature, that's a part of you becoming a child. And me, I'm having, you know, have four kids. It's all about making you imaginary, you know, showing you fantasy, creativity. There was nothing to hold you back. So I thought the brief was brilliant. There's such a wide scope of where you can go. And, as much as I was starting to think like and get away with myself, I then had to reel it back in. I was like, but can I actually do that? Is that, you know, what am I going to be able to do on camera? What is the kitchen, the setup? You know, and you got to try to, you know, not just do things within your comfort zone. I definitely got to go outside your comfort zone, but you got to make things realistically practical. And I was just, you know, trying to make that balance, because often or not, as a chef, we can get carried away and then it doesn't really work out. And that brings me back to saying, being able to progressively hit it consistently. So yeah, it was awesome. It was really, really great brief.
Yeah. And I actually, I really like that your son helped you with some of the little figurines and the clay heart. That was, that was such a lovely touch.
Yeah, it was good. It was good to try to, get everybody involved, you know. Yeah. For that clay hut in particularly, I was thinking of an idea, which I ordered like two or three sets of Jenga, right? You know Jenga. So yeah. I had all these Jenga sets set up, and I was thinking, oh, I can build the house out of Jenga, and then ask one of the judges to move the Jenga, and then it collapsed over the, you know, the meat, and I would be like, oh, I blow your house down for my three little pigs. Oh. And I was like, so yeah, you know, these ideas were coming, and then when like I ordered three Jenga, they came, and I was like, oh no, I can't do that. Like, how am I gonna transport it? How am I gonna be able to build it to last? And if I construct it before, how am I gonna then make it soft enough or vulnerable enough to be able to collapse again? So that was a that didn't go ahead. And then I went along the, sorry,
that was a great idea though.
But yeah, it's just the practicality of it. And you know, my kids was always around. I was telling them this and that, and it was like, oh you wow, cool, this, that, and you know, you want to get him involved. It was him and his godmother as well, and we were all just, you know, making stuff up, and I was saying, this is the idea, how can we do that? And before you know it, each element of the dish on the starter had something, on my fish course had something from the kids, the main course, and just the dessert, I then said, okay, this is meat to you guys, and I did all the building. So yeah.
Yeah, I love the faraway tree. And it looks absolutely stunning. Are we going to see any of these dishes at Orma?
Well, that's actually in the plans. They are coming onto the menu. We just agreed now. It's going to come on the 17th of September. I will be doing my 6-course tasting menu from GBM here. So, yeah.
Oh, exciting. That'll be so, so cool.
Thursdays to Saturdays from the 17th of September, all 6 dishes will be available as it was on GBM. So, yeah.
Oh, brilliant. I am there. Absolutely. I can't wait for that. That's
great. Make sure to say hello.
Yeah, absolutely. What is next for you?
What's next for me? I think, I don't know what's next for anyone, really. We're trying to, right now, priorities, trying to regain customers' confidence in what we do, not just in Orma Mayfair, but I think in hospitality on the whole. You know, there's so many restaurants that has been affected by what's going on through this COVID situation, and we are trying to stabilize, we're trying to regain the customers' confidence, going into a festive period and, you know, welcoming old guests, new guests, in support of hospitality. And, you know, I would be very optimistic to say, where am I and what exactly I'm going to be doing next year when there's so much uncertainty still left off the backhand of this post situation. I mean, the government just brought out the great scheme for August, but what else is next to help to encourage people to go out? You know, it's only so much I can do, whether it's food and so forth, but, you know, we need the customers to come out and dine and give us a try and, you know, have a conversation, you know, with us all and be able to make these things that so happy brought a lot of happiness to people before, you know, about nostalgia of just going out and dining and having a good old laugh over a great glass of wine and an affordable dinner.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's something that we are, you know, always working on, and we're trying to do that here. We are lucky enough to have a restaurant which kind of like can accommodate good social distancing, because we have a front part of the restaurant, we have then a back part of the restaurant. So, you know, we're doing our bits. We're tinkering the way we serve food and so forth. And a lot of the dishes that I create, they normally always have on a tag-on element to it, you know, where you can serve it before this dish or after that dish. Now we will just serve it together, so we limit the amount of times that we go to the table and so forth. But as of now, you know, you can still say we had the training wheels on because it's summer, a lot of everybody's on holiday, the kids, etc. But, you know, coming from like 2 weeks from now, there'll be some new dishes going on, and a week after that, then it would be the GBM menu on, and, you know, we will be trying to be full out again, just doing what we got for this last part of the year, because the first three quarters has been so terrible.
Yeah, it has been pretty difficult for everyone. And have you taken part in the Eat Out to Help Out scheme?
Yes, we do.
Okay, perfect. And in terms of your personal aspirations, so you know, once things do get back to normal again, I mean, do you think that, you know, you'll be working towards Michelin star level?
I think. Okay. Same like Great British Menu, I've always set out to say I would love to achieve a Michelin star. It's another thing that's on my list that will mean, you know, I can't even explain what it will mean. It's very, you know, something that I always look out to. It's that's why I work the way I work, the places I've worked, and I would, you know, absolutely love to obtain my own Michelin star. You know, however, I do feel that the Michelin star is not, it's not just about me and so forth. And that's why I try to have this ethic with my team, because I do feel, you know, regardless or not, you know, whether I'm here or if I'm not here or what's not, they're going to have that day. Whenever that Michelin inspector is, and whenever that Michelin inspector comes in, we got to have staff that's happy and that's working to the optimum, the best that they can do. And I can be rest assured in my mind, regardless of whatever is going along, because everybody got stuff going along and issues. But when you do come into Omomefe's kitchen to work, you're happy to partake, you're happy to do that food. And, you know, whether it's something, an idea that you might give me or what's not, whatever the connection is, you're going to be connected with that food. So I know if I blink my eyes or I go out here to a customer to talk or come back in the kitchen or whatever it is, the food is going to continue to go. Because the Michelin star lies within the team. It's not just one person cooking for the Michelin inspector when we are supposed to be anonymous and I don't know. So I'm trying to get myself as my team along the same pattern, and everybody here that's working, a brilliant set of guys, they are working towards that. And you know, we are from day one, but you can't be just optimistic. We haven't achieved it yet, but it is definitely on the list. It probably would never go from my list, but at the same point in time, if I don't achieve it, am I going to change anything? Yes, I'm going to change things. I'm going to continue to grow. I'm going to continue to change the dishes, the food, and hopefully I can do so within a balance that we are not overly busted on just focusing on that aspect where we forget about the normal, you know, the everyday diners who comes in who just wants to enjoy value for money. So I am still very much just, you know, focus on having that kind of service. And then if we are able to achieve the Michelin star alongside all these ethics and things that we are doing, it will be a brilliant plus, and it will be probably my first A plus ever, in my, you know, so it'd be great.
Well, I think you're close, because when I came to the restaurant, I thought the food was phenomenal. I was blown away by it. So I don't think you're far off. And
thank you.
And so, I mean, your kitchen, you talk about your team a lot. And, you know, I actually saw a really fun clip on the staff canteen of you doing your cleaning twerk.
Oh.
It seems like such a fun environment as well.
Yeah, yeah.
That was brilliant. I think everyone should go onto the staff canteen and watch.
Watch me cleaning some stoves, getting some boom shakalaka, yeah?
yeah, you look like you love doing it.
Yeah, so
we're almost done. I just have one last question for you. Tell me something about yourself that I couldn't possibly know.
Sure. I don't know. I probably gave up all the secrets.
it could be something personal.
I am trying to think now. I get, you know, I told you I went to World Championships in Edmonton 2002.
World to represent for
track and field to represent the UK.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. Maybe if I wasn't a chef, I'll probably be on a strip pole dancing, doing the Google dancer. I don't know. I'm an open book, so there's not much secrets to say. But yeah, I think if anyone does have any questions or ever comes across anything, they can always send me a text or whatever, and I'm more than happy to answer. So
that's very kind, and thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. And guys, if you want to get in touch with Kurth and find out what he's up to, he's at Kurth Gums on Instagram, and I'm at Posh Nosh Girl. Thanks, Kurth. Have a lovely day. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.